new temporary meeting room as there's building work going on in the flat. We've had two talks already on Diptera in the Insect Natural History series, one much earlier on by Paul Reddy, and then one by John and Nigel, and then and now we have the final talk to cover the rest of the Diptera, which is the acalyptrate Diptera, with particular reference to the true fruit flies, the Tephritidae, by Ian White and by Nigel Wyatt. And Ian is going to do the presentation of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda, and good afternoon. We have a nice select gathering, actually, aren't we? So let's press on. I'm going to start with just a couple of slides, just as a sort of recap of information that I know Nigel and John have already gone over to some extent, with the just where the Acalypterati fit within the classification of the Diptera to start with. They belong within the suborder Brachycera. There are two suborders of Diptera, the Nematocera, which Paul Reddy spoke about, and the Brachycera, the rest of which Nigel and John spoke about in their talk. And basically, to simplifying things right down, the Brachycera are those flies whose larvae have a reduced head capsule. Within the Brachycera, we then get some very odd groupings that don't fit with the normal sort of suborder, superfamily type categories, starting with the Muscomorpha. Now, in the Muscomorpha, we have a pupal character, namely that the pupa is exudate and in most cases is formed within a puparium. Now, if you look at the left here, you'll see this is the puparium. It's a sort of torpedo-shaped structure formed from the skin of the last larval instar. Normally, the third instar larva would be the last one. Within that, you get the true pupa, which looks a little bit like the pupa of a beetle. In that it's got, as it develops, you start to see the legs folded up on it, the wing pads, etc. The group within that is that we're interested in is the Schizophora. Now, the Schizophora are defined by the presence in the adults of a telinum. Now, a telinum is a structure between the antennae at the front of the head, which is a sort of fluid-filled sac that's pushed out when they emerge from the puparium, and it bursts open the end of the puparium. If you want a sort of modern mechanical analogy, think of a driver's airbag in a car, and that's pretty much what the telinum looks like. And then as the emerged fly then hardens, so it retracts that sac, pulls the sclerite, the telinal sclerite, back into position between the antennae, and the telinal fissure fuses up. Then within the Schizophora, there are two groups. There's the calyptrates, which includes things like the housefly, and the acalyptrates. And the acalyptrates have reduced what are called calyptares. That's the basal flange of the wing, behind the high margin of the wing, a large flap that the housefly type groups have. And there's a suture across the thorax, which is reduced in the acalyptrates. I'm not going to dwell greatly on taxonomic characters, but I have just put in a couple of slides, one of a head, one of a wing here, just to give an idea of the sort of characters that are used in classifying some of the families. There are around 20,000 species of acalyptrates that have been described so far. That's about 20% of the order. They are divided into some 60 to 80 families, depending on whose classification you follow, and those families are grouped normally into 8 superfamilies. And I'm not going to follow the superfamily classification in this talk, as you'll see in just a minute. The sort of characters which I will just mention is that in the higher Diptera, the antennae are reduced down to just 3 segments: scape, pedicel, and what we call the first flagellomere. Which in the older literature, such as this, is still called the third antennal segment. Most families then have this structure here called the arista. In some groups, the arista might be plumose or pectinate. In others, it's bare. The head has a lot of CT on it, which are homologized or homologizable, we think. For example, there are these forward-pointing ocellar CT here, which in some groups are absent, in some groups are very short. These CT here, the post-ocellar bristles, in some groups they're convergent, as shown there. In some other families they're divergent. In others they are forward-pointing, in other words, proclinate. In others they may point backwards, they reclinate. And the relative lengths and directions of these various CT are sometimes important family characters. On the wing, generally speaking, there's not a lot of variation in the overall pattern of venation in amongst the acalypterate families. But there are some important characters nonetheless. For example, there's a thing here labelled the subcostal break. Some families have it, some families lack it. It's a very awkward character to interpret, actually, because you can often imagine there's a subcostal break when there isn't, and vice versa. If you actually were to take wings off things and put them on a slide to convince yourself that it's a character that works. The subcosta in some families and some subfamilies of Agrimycetae, for example, is fused with vein R1. In others, it's separate, as shown here. Another feature you might find is that this, what they've called here, the second basal cell and the discal cell, might be fused. That basal cross vein is absent in some groups, such as chloropids and ephydrids. In some of the Tephritoidea, superfamily Tephritoidea, there's a long extension, a long pointed extension to this cell here, the anal cell as it's called on this diagram. The classification that I'm going to use in this talk is an entirely artificial one, to which there are numerous exceptions, but it happens to make for a convenient way of taking a quick ramble through some example families. Saprophagus, which is really a polite way of saying we don't know what their biology is in most cases. Coprophagus, there are very few things that are necrophagous, but those that are also tend to be associated with stored food. There are a number of families which are loosely speaking parasitic, or at least ways specialist predators, and you'll see what I mean by that category when we get to it. Then I've got a category which I called rice, grass and marsh, which is much more of a sort of habitat thing than anything else. And finally, I'm going to talk about some families which contain a lot of phytophagous species. And within that, concentrating on the Tephritidae. And I will, in fact, devote almost half the talk to that one exemplar family. Amongst the saprophages, I'm going to briefly mention three families and a few others which are large enough not to want to leave out completely. The first family I'm going to mention is the Psilophidae. Now, this is rather a bizarre family. To anybody who didn't know this was a Dipteran, they probably think it was a chrysomelid beetle. The remarkable thing about Psilophids is that the scutellum is greatly enlarged. This is the scutellum. I mean, it's normally a very small part of the thorax. In most Diptera, the scutellum would be about as long as I'm waving the arrow around at the moment. In the Psilophids, it's extended right back over the whole of the abdomen and covers the wings. And the... turn that around slightly. We know very little about the biology of the Psilophids. Examples are some which have been found associated with the yellowing foliage of cowpeas. There is evidence that some may be associated with grasses in some way, but there's no indication that they're anything other than saprophagus, feeding on essentially decaying vegetable matter. The Drosophilidae is the second largest family in the Acalypterati. 2,500 described species, and 60% of them belong to just one genus, Drosophila. Or, however, there's a fairly high morphological diversity with almost 40 other genera. Most species, again, are associated with some sort of decaying organic material. The largest subfamily, the Drosophilinae, are mostly microfungi feeders. For example, a great many of the genus Drosophila are often associated with yeast, and of course including the famous Drosophila melanogaster, which is the fruit fly of the geneticist. Fruit fly, I should mention, is a complete misnomer when it comes to the Drosophilidae. It's only geneticist and a few British entomologists, actually, who tend to apply the term fruit fly to Drosophila. Elsewhere, the term fruit fly generally means the Tephritids. And this misnomer has come about because of the fact that a lot of Drosophila are seen buzzing around the fruit bowl in the house, but what they're really after is yeasts and other microorganisms growing on fruit that's slightly overripe, or indeed possibly rotten. Some Drosophilinae are, however, truly phytophagous. There are a few that are leaf miners, for example, in the genus Skeptomyza. Another group of Drosophilidae is the subfamily Sticinini. And although, again, some are saprophagous, there are some very specialist predators in the Sticinini associated with Haemoptera, particularly whitefly, mealybugs and scales, and delphacids. There are also some very odd biologies in the Drosophilidae. For example, there are three species that have been recorded as commensals on crabs, actually breeding in the bronchial chambers of the crabs, or feeding on their excretory products. The Lonchiidae is a medium-sized family. It belongs to the superfamily Tephritoidea, which is recognized by the fact that the female has this long telescopic ovipositor, something which I'll be saying a bit more about later on. Only a small number of genera, 9, but they're found in most world regions. We believe that most of them are saprophagous. There are some exceptions. For example, there are some species that are regularly associated with fruit, in most cases attacking fruit that's already been punctured by fruit flies, the Tephritid fruit flies. But there is some evidence that a few of them may actually be primary attackers of fruit. Some are in burrows in timber. It's believed that at least some of those have predatory larvae, possibly feeding on beetles, and in Papua New Guinea and Northern Australia, possibly feeding on antler flies, which are a group of Tephritids that I'll be saying a bit more about later. Some other families of saprophages which are too big to simply ignore: the Loxoniidae, the Millichiidae, Otitidae, and Platystomatidae. The Otitids and the Platystomatids are again members of the superfamily Tephritoidea. They have this long telescopic ovipositor. In the Millichiids, the most commonly encountered genus is Desmomatopa. Desmomatopa is the only group of flies that I've ever come across which carries its own DET label. It has this wonderful great letter M across the fronds to tell you that it's a species of Millichiidae. There are a number of acalypterates that can be found associated with dung, and primarily this is a habit for the Sepsidae and the Spherocerida. The illustration here, incidentally, gives you an idea of some of the sort of leg characters that we find in male sepsids, and other families would have similar characters too in some cases. Sepsidae is a fairly small family, about 250 species and 20 or so genera. They're found in all regions of the world. They have a very distinct appearance. They all look like little ants. They have this very round head, fairly long legs, a slight wasp waist, these very elongate wings, and in almost all cases they have exactly the same pattern on the wings. They have this dark spot at the apex of vein R2 plus 3. Sometimes they can swarm in quite large numbers, and they move around flapping these little wings as they with the little spots on the end. Spherocerida, this is the family that Brian Pitkin did his postgraduate work on. A large, fairly large family, getting on for 1,000 species, a large number of genera found in all regions. They develop in decaying material, mostly dung, but sometimes also carrion. They can build up very large populations and reach nuisance levels. Very distinctive looking flies, very stocky, with, in all cases, this enlarged first segment of the hind tarsomere. The wings, one tribe, Leptocerinae, have a very reduced wing venation. And that's one of the few cases where wing venation really is quite different to the general acalyptrate pattern. The only family that really specializes in living on carrion and the domestic version of carrion, which is stored meat and cheese, is the Pyophilidae. There are around 70 species, some 20 or so genera, again found in all regions. Pyophilicaceae is particularly well known. It's the cheese skipper. And the larvae have special appendages at their posterior end with which they can grab, with their mouth hooks and then suddenly release, which causes these larvae to jump. And this skipping of the cheese skipper larvae appears to be an escape method. And pupae of the cheese skipper have even been found in such an unlike place as Egyptian mummies. There are a few exceptions. For example, there's a species called Neotyophyllum praustum, the larvae of which develop in birds' nests where they suck the blood of the nestlings. Heavy infestations may even cause death of a nestling. Now I'm going on to a category which I've rather loosely called parasites, predators and equilines. There are a few things in here which I've rather sort of shoehorned into this. This, by the way, is the head of a species of Scyomyzid, belonging to the genus Cepidon, with these rather unusual forward-pointing antennae and this very strange head shape. Or triangular shaped head in profile. This is the only example I'm going to give in this talk of a wingless fly. There's just one genus of Brolidae. Within that genus, there's either one species or five, according to whose paper you read. And it's called Brolaceca. It's the bee louse. The adults are phoretic on adult bees, where they apparently feed on regurgitated honey. And the larvae tunnel into the wax of bee combs. They're generally thought to be simply inquiline, although a few people do suspect that they do a certain amount of damage and regard them as pests. A great many acalyptrates, if we're being perfectly honest, don't have a known biology. And the genus, the family Camillidae, of which there's just one genus, Camilla, with about 10 species, I've placed here as partly as an example of something we really don't know much about. But I put them in with the parasites, etc. ones, because the larvae are always found in association with rodent burrows. And the larvae apparently live in the soil at the entrance to rodent burrows. However, as Fleet Street's Finest will tell you, trying to find out the lifestyle of Camilla is rather a difficult task. Charomyidae. This is a family which, when I was doing identifications for IIE, I always found very difficult to identify if they were sent to me in alcohol, and extraordinarily easy to place to family if they were sent to me as dried specimens. And I can remember a number of occasions in my sort of more naive days when I get these little black flies out of alcohol and I'd spend about half an hour trying to track them down through a family key. And I'd come down to Camomiaidae and I think, why didn't I recognise them for that to start with? And I'd take them out of alcohol and I'd let them dry out and they'd go a beautiful silvery grey colour. And there are no other eucalyptrates that are a beautiful silvery grey colour. It's so distinctive, but the obvious spot character is completely lost the moment they get damp or wet. It's a fairly small family, only 160 or so described species, but as anybody who's tried working on the group will tell you, there are probably 10 times that number of undescribed ones sitting in collections waiting to be worked on. They're mainly north temperate. They are very specialist predators, very much along the same lines as the Stegonine drosophilids, in that they attack aphids and coccids. The eggs are actually laid, for example, into aphid colonies where the larvae suck the aphids dry. And there is some biocontrol interest in them. The Cryptochaetidae are very distinctive looking flies, very robust bodied. No arista, which everything else we've looked at has an arista sticking off the antenna, but not in the Cryptochaetids. The wings are rather short by comparison to the size of the body. It's a small family, only one genus. They're old world. They are once again associated with Hemoptera. These are parasitoids of Margaroded scales. The eggs are laid into the hemocoel. Generally speaking, perhaps half a dozen or so larvae might develop in one scale, but up to 17 have been recorded. And there's one species that has been used in the biocontrol of the Cockney cushion scale in citrus. The Pagotidae, medium-sized family, mainly old world tropics. Quite large flies, some of them. Some of them are sort of an inch or more in length. And they belong to the Tephritoidea, that's this superfamily that have the telescopic ovipositor. And the basal segment of the ovipositor, that's the visible part of the ovipositor in Pagotids, frequently it's bright orange and extraordinarily heavily sclerotized. And it looks a bit like a sort of traffic cone stuck on the end of the abdomen. And they are endoparasitoids of adult scarab-eared beetles. Now, anybody who knows the first thing about scarab-eared beetles will realize that they're practically armor-plated. And to be an endoparasitoid of an adult scarab-eared beetle is going to take some fairly specialist adaptations. And apparently what they do, a great many of them actually pounce on flying beetles so that they can overposit into the dorsal surface of the abdomen, which of course is not armor-plated, while the elytra are open. Although it's believed that some others actually overposit through the anus. And pupariation actually takes place within the dead host. The Scyomyzidae are rather borderline between what you call parasites and what you might call predators. Fairly large family, around 60 genera. The two main tribes are the Scyomyzini and the Tetanocerini. The Scyomyzini mainly attack land snails, and they are semi-parasitic in the sense that one larval instar develops on one host in some cases, then they move on to kill another snail with the next larval instar and so on. Or in some other cases, the entire development will take place on a single host. The Tetanocerini, however, are specialist predators, mainly of freshwater mollusca. The eggs are laid on the vegetation, sticking up out of the water, and the larvae then crawl down into the water to find the snails on that vegetation. A lot of them are quite large flies, some of them sort of half to three quarters of an inch in length, fairly long legged, often brightly coloured. This particular thing, Cepidon, this genus, a very striking spine patterns on their hind femora. Now I'm going on to my penultimate category, which I'm calling rice, grass and marsh. The larva that you see an illustration of there, the head is at the right hand end. These are respiratory siphons, spiracles at the end. These curious looking protuberances here develop around a rootlet of an aquatic plant. And they are filter feeders. This is a member of the genus Ephydra. And some species, such as Ephydra afghana, can sometimes build up to such huge numbers in rice plantations that they can actually uproot the rice because they're slightly buoyant. So although they're not actually primary pests, they're not feeding on the rice, they can nonetheless do a great deal of damage. The Chloropidae, this is the third largest family of acalypterates, over 1,200 species found in all regions, particularly notable in grasslands. Many are primary attackers of grasses. For example, in oak crops, frit fly can sometimes build up to huge numbers, a tiny little black fly. There are also some pests of sorghum. The illustration here is of a species of chlorops, which are typically bright yellow flies, about half housefly size. But there are many other biologies in the Chloropidae. For example, one Australian genus, Bactromia, has larvae that develop under the skins of frogs where they suck the blood. And there are a couple of species which are known as eye flies because they feed on mammalian secretions and cluster around the eyes, particularly of farm animals, but also sometimes of humans, and they can be facultative spreaders of eye infections. The Diopsidae is the principal family of what are called stork-eyed flies. Brian Cogan once told me that there are 9 families of acalypterates that include stork-eyed examples. I once worked out what 7 of them were, and I never worked out what the other 2 were that he was referring to. The Diopsidae are unusual in that the storks are found in both sexes, not just males, which is usually the case in other families. And also it's not just the eyes that are at the end of the stalks, it's also the antennae. The stalks appear to have at least a couple of functions. They can sort of see round corners, so to speak, when they're on a grass stem, see something else coming. But most importantly of all, they can use them to spar with. They can size each other up. It's a bit like 2 deer sizing up each other's antlers to see who's going to get the females. And here you can see 2 diopsid, probably males, sparring on a grass stem. They mostly live in wet habitats, the larvae develop in grasses, but not always as a primary attacker. In many cases they appear to be in grasses that are already rotting. But some are primary attackers, including some that are rice pests. The Ephydridae is another one of the large families of acalypterates, 1,500 or so species, about 70 genera. A great many of them, probably most of them, have this rather frog-like appearance to the head. It's as if somebody's chopped off the bottom of the head to leave an absolutely huge gaping epistome. A great many of them are found in marshy situations. In fact, that's probably the main habitat for ephydrids. Some are phytophagous. For example, the genus Hydrelia includes a few rice pests. Some others are predators and scavengers. For example, there's a genus called Octhera, which if you were to take a sweep net around any sort of acidic pool in this part of the world, you would be very likely to find adults of Octhera. And these are mantid-like flies. They have raptorial front legs, like little praying mantis. Now, moving on to my final category, which is the Phytophagus group. Firstly, the Agrimycidae, which is another group Brian Pitkins worked on. 2,500 species or thereabouts, but actually quite a small number of genera for such a large family, only about 30 genera, found in all regions. As far as we're aware, they are all phytophagous. The larvae develop, generally speaking, in leaf and stem lines, but there are some that bore into legume pods. A great many of them are serious pests. For example, members of the genus Melanagramyza in bean pods, and leaf miners such as Liriomyza trifolii, some of which are very specialist, others are highly prolificous. For example, Liriomyza trifolii has a wide range of hosts that includes tomato, potato, and ornamentals. And as is commonly the case with phytophagous pests, some of them have been spread around the world as the result of the activities of man. Liriomyza trifolii is originally northern South American, and because there's a lot of cut flower growing in Colombia to serve North America, and also there's cut flower growing in Kenya to serve Europe, and there has been rather poorly inspected transportation of flowers between the two, swapping materials, Liriomyza trifolii at some time back in the 70s was able to make it from northern South America to East Africa, from northern South America into North America, and from East Africa up into Europe and also into Asia. The Micropaesidae, I've included them here with the Phytophagus groups, although in reality most are Saprophagus, but there are some Phytophagus examples, particularly some which are pests of ginger roots. There are also some that live in the root nodules of legumes. They're very distinctive looking flies. They have remarkably long legs and very long thin wings and a rather rounded head. There's another similar family called the Neuriidae, which has a much more elongate head. The Psyllidae is a fairly small family with only 5 genera, mainly phytophagous, or so we believe. The best known example is Psylla rosae, the carrot fly, the larvae of which develop in the roots of carrots and other umbelliferas, for example, fennel and parsnip. The carrot fly Psylla rosae is a native of Europe, but like other pests that it's been moved around, and it's now also established in North America and in New Zealand. I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about one exemplar family, the Tephritidae, which coincidentally happens to be the group that I work on. It's the largest family of acalypterates, which is the real reason that I'm taking it as the example, of course, with over 4,000 species. An astonishing morphological diversity in that it has over 500 genera. We estimate that something like 95% of the family are phytophagous, and over 200 species have been reared from plants that have a commercial value of some sort. Of those, about 100 in sufficient numbers to be regarded as pests, at least on some occasions, and perhaps 30 or so of those as very serious pests. Conversely, some Tephritids attack weeds and actually have a use in plant biocontrol. The classification of the family is fairly straightforward, at least at the subfamily level, and is worth mentioning therefore. One group, the Deicinae, are almost exclusively fruit feeders. The Tripetinae are a mixture. They include fruit feeders, some leaf and stem miners, and the very small number of species that are saprophagous. The Tephritinae, which largely, some probably 95% of them, infest the flower heads of Asteraceae, and some of them form galls. The galls may either be in the flower heads, or in some cases they may be stem galls or shoot tip galls. Now, I have mentioned the telescopic ovipositor of the superfamily Tephritoidea a few times, and this is a little bit more about its structure. It consists of three segments. The segment that you actually see when it's retracted is known as the ovoscape. The apical segment is the aculeus, which is formed of the two terminal segments of the abdomen fused into a single sclerite. Linking the ovoscape and the aculeus is a membrane which allows the aculeus to slide in and out of the ovoscape. And that's known as the aversible ovipositor sheath. And in that drawing, that shows the aculeus about 50% extended, which is about the position it would be extended to for oviposition and also for copulation. And these things probably have the longest male penis in the world, because it has to get all the way from there up to about there somewhere. And if you dissect the abdomen of a male, you find this huge great tube coiled up inside it. One of the curious factors of working on Tephritids is that in many cases it's the females rather than the males that yield the best taxonomic characters for separating species. The aculeus yields two types of diagnostic information: its apex shape and its length. I often relate length to the length of the discal cell as being a very convenient way of standardizing the length of the aculeus. And in many of the groups where the aculeus yields the most useful characters for species identification, we find that the males yield very good characters for subgenus identification or genus identification. And in fact, this morning I was looking at some types of species that I hadn't seen before, and not surprisingly, I found something described from a female only, which is a synonym of something described in another subgenus. And it's very easy for people to have missed things like that simply because the subgeneric classification is based on males. If we want to make a sort of ecological classification of the family, we've got the very small group of saprophagous things, then we've got leaf miners, a few of which are actually minor pests. Then we've got some 80% of the family, which we believe attack seed-bearing organs of plants. And those divide roughly evenly between flower feeders, which include some species of biocontrol interest, and fruit feeders, which include the many pest species. Earlier on I mentioned antler flies. These are the antler flies, which I've put here as an example of the small saprophagus group. They belong to the genus Phytalmia, which is found primarily in Papua New Guinea. There are a few species of Phytalmia that get down into Australia. This is Phytalmia moldsi, which is probably the least spectacular species of Phytalmia. And I apologise for the fact that I couldn't find any film of the more spectacular ones, such as this thing, Phytalmia cervicornis. These are the males that have the antlers. This is the front of the head. You can see the antennae and the arista. And then these are genal extensions, cheek extensions. And if we watch the film for a moment, this is a male making an approach to a female. No, running away. That's a nice patch of fungus, and you'll see in a minute that's what they're interested in. There's a female ovipositing, being guarded by the male. Here's a male again. This is two males having a fight. And unlike the diopsids, which just size each other up, these things really do fight, as we'll see in a moment. Two males, they're on a fallen log. This is their typical host, if you like, is logs. They're fairly restrictive in the logs that they go for, but it's fungal attack in the log that they're actually overpositing into. They rear right up. The female, no antlers, and see the pointed abdomen. The male again, the approach. Overposition. There you see the female underneath the male on the right while they're in cot, and another male trying to horn in on the act. Moving on to the leaf miners, this is a picture of Eulia heraclei, which is the European celery fly. In North America, they have a species called Eulia fratria, which I'm not actually sure is really any different. I've never really stopped and studied them very carefully. I'm not at all convinced that they're different at all. Something like 15% of the family probably have a leaf, stem or root association. Other pests apart from the celery fly are the asparagus fly, which again is a European species. And in Southeast Asia, there are some flies which attack the shoots of bamboo. The flower feeders are around 40% of the family. In Europe, they're more like 95% of the family, but worldwide, they're probably only about 40%. This includes a few gall formers. Mostly they are in the subfamily Tephritinae, and Tephritines as a rule have these maculate wings, a sort of dark pattern broken up by hyaline spots. There are some exceptions. In this one, this is a species of Tephritis that lives on a pordon, these thistles that grow up sort of 5 or 6 feet high, and the reticulate pattern in this particular Tephritis is broken down almost into a banding. But you can see in this photograph just how cryptic that sort of coloration is when they're on a plant. Most of them attack just one family of plants. They attack the Asteraceae, or the Compositae, whichever you care to call them. There are some exceptions. In Australia, there are a number of species that have adapted to attacking Goodiniaceae. Goodiniaceae do actually have some chemicals in common with some Asteraceae, and some botanists do think that they're closely related. But in Africa and southern Europe, there's a group an entire group that has specialised on a totally different group of plants, namely the very aromatic plants belonging to the families Acanthaceae, Lamiaceae, or dead nettle family, and the Verbena family, Verbenaceae. Gall formation, in many cases it's within a flower, so you can't even see the gall unless you dissect the flower open. In some cases it's on a stem. These two galls here are both formed by species of a genus called Europhora. This is a stem gall of Europhora cardui on field thistle, Circe marvense. This is a flowerhead gall of Europhora stylata on Circium vulgari. And the gall is formed from receptacle tissue, which swells up around the developing achenes and lignifies. And here, where the achenes should be, we've got puparia of the Europhora. One Europhora larva per achene, replacing the seeds completely. And there's some soft tissue above here, which at the end of winter, when the adult emerges, it can just push its way out through the soft and rotting flower head. Now, some of these have been used as component parts of plant biocontrol programs, and about 20 species of Tephritidae in all have been tried. The largest target group of plants is European plants that are adventive in North America. The main genus used is Eurofera, primarily against the genus Centauria, that's knapweeds and star thistles. About six slides to go, Linda. This is an example. This is yellow star thistle, Centauria solstitialis, which is native to the southern Palearctic. It's adventive in the western United States, where it covers, or did cover, something like 3 million hectares of rangeland. And a Eurofera species was released in the 60s and 70s, but the releases repeatedly failed to become established. Now, I managed to team up with somebody in United States Department of Agriculture. They had, conveniently, they have weed bar control stations both in Rome and in northeastern Greece. And what we arranged to do was plant out American yellow star thistle in both of these sites in a garden surrounded by the local yellow star thistle, which was heavily infested by the local Eurofera attacking it. And what we found was that in Rome, the American plants were completely unattacked, despite, according to botanists, being absolutely identical to the local plants. But in northeastern Greece, the American plants were as heavily attacked as the local plants were. The flies were then sent to me, and I found when I dissected the aculeus, that's the apical part of the ovipositor, the female, that the Greek flies had this stepped apex to the aculeus. The Italian flies had a simple pointed aculeus. They were quite different species of flies, although morphologically, in every other respect, they looked the same. Survey work was carried out, and we found out that the Italian species was widespread right down through Italy, that's this one with the pointed aculeus, and through most of Greece. They just got lucky, because where they had their garden plots in northeastern Greece was right on the extreme western end of the range of this other species. I found it in Crete while I was doing some collecting during my honeymoon. You know, you have to do something in your honeymoon. Subsequently, it's been found throughout Turkey. That fly has now been released in North America, and it has established, and it is making a contribution to the biocontrol effort. Fruit feeders, estimated to be something like 40% of the family. Most of the pest species belong to just five genera. Unlike the flower feeders, which usually puperiate in their host, the fruit feeders usually puperiate in the soil, and mostly they're tropical. In this film, you can see this is medfly in an artificial rearing medium. This is somebody sifting through some of the maggots in the rearing medium. There's maggots in a stone fruit, peach or nectarine. There's the adult, female. And that's laying an egg through a membrane in the artificial rearing system. The main genera, Anastrepha, is the main genus in the tropical Americas, with pest species attacking things like citrus, mango, guava, and cucurbits. Ceratitis is the main pest genus in the Afrotropical area, but one species, medfly, has spread elsewhere. It's spread throughout most of the rest of the tropics, with the exception of Asia. There are some 90 or so species. Again, citrus, mango, guava, and stone fruits are the main hosts. The subgenus Ceratitis, the males all have these capitate ceti, these orbital ceti with these structures on the end, apically expanded ends, sorry, frontal ceti rather. And Ceratitis capitata has them about half the length of this species. This is a species, a non-pest species in Kenya. Regalitis is an important genus in the temperate areas. These Regalitis, they tend to be very host-specific. Some of them have been used as essentially laboratory animals for studying St. Patrick speciation, the North American apple maggot fly. And then the fourth and fifth major pest genera are Bactrossera and Dacus. Africa, it's mainly Dacus, something like 200 species, specializing in the attack of cucurbits and asclepiads, and there are a few on Passiflorace. In the Asia-Pacific Australian region, it's mostly the genus Bactrossera, some 500 described species, one group specializing on cucurbits, and another group which goes for just about everything other than cucurbits, including, again, things like mango, guava, starfruit, papaya, and stone fruits. One odd feature of the biology of these frugivorous fruit flies that's worth a quick mention is the phenomenon of the male lure. Now, we've known about male lures for a very, very long time. We've used them, artificial male lures, to collect males for pest monitoring, and we can even use them for control. For example, when papaya fruit fly got into northern Queensland recently, within a 2-year period, they were able to trap out enough males to suppress the population right down and actually eradicate the species from North Queensland. They're very useful for identification. We don't know of a single confirmed example where a species goes for more than a single lure, so we can actually use the type of lure that something was attracted to as a taxonomic character. But what do they do in nature? Well, this is something we're only just starting to understand, and it appears that males gather the lure when they're young to augment their pheromone, and they are, this is basically an aphrodisiac. They are sexier. If you put males that are fed on methyl eugenol or Q-lure in a cage with females and some other males that have not fed, it is the fed males that will have the greatest mating success. Have I got time just for about 3 slides on expanding host range? Okay. I mentioned that pest species of flies have often been spread around by man, and there are 3 main types of spread that I'd like to just give a single example of. Firstly, ancient spread, going back thousands of years as agriculture developed, so pests moved with it. Spread by early shipping, and spread by modern trade. Botanists now believe that the European cultivated olive, Olea europaea, is a cultivar of African olive, Olea africana, or Olea europaea subspecies africana, according to whose book you're looking. If that's the case, then obviously olive fly, which is a serious pest right around the Mediterranean, can't possibly have had a host in the Mediterranean before the arrival of the cultivated olive. Now, the cultivated olive, because ancient civilizations, just like modern civilizations, were oil-based economies, the only difference was that they were olive oil-based economies instead of mineral oil-based economies. Consequently, we know a great deal about the spread of olive culture over a very long period of time. And therefore, we can more or less put dates on the earliest possible arrival of the olive fly in various countries. I won't dwell on that any further. Let's move on. Ceratitis capitata is an unusual fly in that its type locality, Mark de Meyer from Tervuren, who's sitting here in the audience, recently realised, puzzling for a long time over its type locality, that when it said, can you quote it exactly?
It said, captured in the Indian Ocean by Mr. Daldor.
Ah, doesn't it also in the
long
on Ostindiaman? Ostindian?
No, it just said on the heading that it is from the East Indies. So the one who described it thought it was East Indies, but within the text it says this remarkable fly was captured by Mr. Daldor in the Indian Ocean.
Right, okay. Well, the way we have thought about this was that the ships of the East India Company were known as East Indiaman, and the Dutch East India Company ships were known as Dutch East Indiaman. It seems likely that the reference to Dutch East Indies actually referred to a Dutch East Indies Company ship, and hence the fact that the description also says in Ostindia, in Mare Indica rather, the Indian Ocean. So we think that the type locality of this fly was actually a ship at sea, which fits in very nicely with its early spread. It was spread around before modern trade was spreading fruit around, but very much coincident with the time when sailing ships were carrying antiscorbutics. In other words, they were carrying citrus fruits and vegetables to prevent the development of scurvy. And it's quite likely that that accounts for the early spread of this particular species. More recently, we've got lots of examples we could draw on. One particular one that I've had involvement with is the peach fruit fly. The peach fruit fly appears to have become, is a South Asian species, India, Sri Lanka. It appears to have been established in Egypt since about 1980, but was overlooked. In fact, it was being misidentified for some 10 or more years. And in the mid-1990s, it was finally sent here. And I looked at it and I said, oh gosh, that's Bacteroscera zonata, peach fruit fly, what's that doing in Egypt? The appropriate UN agency then launched a survey, and it turned out that it was very well established throughout the Nile Valley. They estimate the losses now at being something like US dollars, $177 million a year. Had they sent it in for identification through an £80 ID fee 20 years ago, maybe it wouldn't be costing them quite so much. And of course, it's a great concern to us because it's also a threat to climatically suitable areas of southern Europe and North Africa, from which we can draw, and I'm sorry for going on to unnatural history for the last three slides, but we can draw one conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Ian, and also Nigel for your part in it too, for a really interesting and comprehensive tour of the acliptrate flies. Just before I throw it over for questions, I must say something I forgot to say earlier, and that is that Dick and Malcolm both sent their apologies for not being able to attend this meeting. They were unfortunately forced to go to another meeting and so couldn't be here, although they would have loved to have done so otherwise. And having said that, also thank you very much, Ian, for showing some wonderful live clips. It's really great to see some insects in action for a change as well. That's really lovely. Thanks a lot.
I do actually have the means to show them full screen, separate to the presentation, if anybody's keen to have a look afterwards, or we can play them while we're having a drink or something like that.
Right. Ian and Nigel will take questions now, if anybody wants to start with all home.
Well, while you're sort of talking about those video clips, where did you actually get them from? I see they're copyright BBC.
By illicitly hanging on to any natural history programmes or agricultural programmes that had appropriate bits in them. Okay. But the capturing of them is very, very simple. If you've got a TV card and a computer and some bits of software you can download from the usual American freebie sites, freeware, legally freeware, to do the editing and the compressing, it's very easy to turn them into clips on the computer.
Quite a number of the toadfishes have markings, sort of quite striking patterns on the wings, don't they? Are most of them actually for camouflage, or do some of them have other functions?
I think there's an element of signalling. So a chap called Helmut Zwölfer back in the 60s or 70s did some work on some of the European tephritines, looking at how they moved their wings when they were signalling to each other, and found that while some did this and some did this, and it actually varied from genus to genus, there were sort of genus specific ways of moving the wings. The patterns between species within a genus are not usually that great. Some exceptions. And I suspect that what really matters is not the pattern that we see when we're looking at a stationary wing, but the pattern that the wing draws through the air when it's moving at high speed. And if we were to go back to the tephritines, I just encourage us to go back a few slides. And look at those. Those four different species of detritus at bottom left there. The right hand one always has these two marks isolated from this big mark here. But if we took these two, for example, the most extreme variation of that one and the most extreme variation of that one could easily be confused, very easily be confused by the taxonomist. Some of them will have these bits more joined up, some of them will have these bits less joined up, some of them will have this not very well developed, some of them will have this bit better developed. And what you actually find is that you very often can recognise the things better with the naked eye than you can when you get things under the microscope. You often find once you've got that wing under the microscope, you start to see too much. You can't see the wood for the trees anymore. Was it the other way around? But I think sometimes if you look at them, look at the sort of gist of the pattern, you're perhaps getting a much better idea of the fly's eye view of the pattern than you are otherwise. And I think there are a lot of other things that go along with this too. I mean, if you look at the scutum patterning of these things, for example, we tend rather to ignore the taxonomic significance of scutum patterning simply because it's so easily damaged. But Tony Shelley, I know, has found that microtrichia patterning on the scutum of simuliids is a valuable taxonomic character. And I found on some day signs that you get quite different patterns according to whether you're looking on top or from in front. And from in front, you get patterns that separate sympatric, commonly occurring together species. From on top, the whole darn lot look the same. And I suspect, perhaps, sticking my neck out rather here, but maybe from on top, you're seeing a predator's eye view. And from in front, you're seeing something that matters to the signalling systems between the flies.
Afterwards.
It's been a warm afternoon.
Right. Well, thank you again very much. We have wine and soft drinks in the bucket as usual. Yeah, thanks. So.